This is HPR episode 2266 entitled Gamebooks, Lone Wolf, and is part of the series Tabletop Gaming. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 43 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is, Klaatu talks about the Lone Wolf solo RPG series.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everyone, my name is Klaatu, this is Hacker Public Radio, and this is an entry into my tabletop gaming series. Which, by the way, this probably doesn't need to be said, but maybe it does need to be said. This is in no way a series owned by me, so if you have any desire whatsoever to contribute to this series or to add, you know, a cool game that you have found into this series, you are more than welcome to. You don't have to ask HPR admin for permission. You don't have to ask me for permission. This is not... in any way, there's no lesson plan here, I don't have an overarching, idea of how this all needs to go. Just, if you have a game that you want to talk about, throw it into this series, and that way, people will, you know, be able to just kind of go to the gaming series and find all of our gaming, chats. I mean, you don't have to, I'm just putting that up, I'm offering it up to HPR. To feel free to use the tabletop gaming series as a label rather than treating it as an actual, you know, series with an A, B, C kind of linear flow. Okay, so that was that. So in this episode, I guess I'm kind of starting almost a sub-series here about gaming books. And you might think, what's a gaming book? And a gaming book is a thing that that I associate with kind of like the 80s, pretty much. That's probably not even correct, but that's the world that I have imagined everything existing in, is that gaming books were huge in the 80s. I don't know why I made that choice, that decision, but that's my impression. And to be honest, to some degree, I think I might be right. Gaming books at some point fell out of fashion, and I think the point at which that was is the point when video games started taking the stage. I mean, video games were around, but I mean, video games started getting good, you know, like early 90s, right? I mean, some people would argue, no, the 80s, the early 80s, or the mid 80s, whatever. But I mean, let's face it, really, the 90s were when sort of video games actually became a thing. You started getting the point and click adventures, you started getting really cool platformers with actual stories rather than just sort of the put a quarter into the arcade machine and just keep playing the same five levels with some, you know, with a faster timing. So at that point, when people could start gaming on their computers, I think that the gaming books kind of became almost obsolete, because a gaming book pretty much serves or can serve one important purpose, which would be to enable someone to do a solo game. So if you don't have a group of three or four friends gathered together and you want to do some dungeon crawling, you sort of couldn't do that. But gaming books came around and put you into a world where actually, yes, you could do that. You could go through a whole narrative just by yourself, and it really felt, you know, like a game. It was a gaming experience for one person. And that's really cool. And I kind of started looking for this, not because I thought, oh, I should check out some gaming books. I just had this vague memory of this book series called The White Warrior and the Black Baron. And maybe some of you have heard of it. But when I was a kid, I found these two books, and one was called the White Warrior, and one was called the Black Baron. And I mean, that wasn't like the color of their skin; that was just their color of their clothes. It wasn't racist. It was just their clothes. And there was actually another pair of books called the Ruby something and the Emerald something. Like a wizard, I think. But I didn't know about those at the time. I just found out about those later. So I found these books, and they looked cool, you know, because they had like fantasy art on them, and I was always really into that. So I thought, well, I'm going to look at these. So I got them and looked through them, and they were just every page was a corridor, like a first person view of a corridor, and that was intriguing, so I kind of tried to figure it out. I mean, I don't know why I never thought to just read the instructions, which were right there in the front of the book, but as a kid, I wasn't super patient with that sort of thing. So I kind of like made up my own sort of way of going through this, and there was a lot of confusion for me as a kid because it was sort of the actual books, as it turns out, and I now know this, were both single-player and two-player. So it was really quite interesting. You could either just buy one book and play through it as in single player mode, and the way that you do that is you look at the picture, you know, you start at whatever page it tells you to start at in the instructions, and you're dropped off in this castle or a maze or something, and you're supposed to, in single player mode, mind you, you're supposed to find all of the treasure chests around the maze and answer a riddle at each treasure chest, and if you answer the riddle, then you get an item, you get some loot to write down on your notepad, and then you continue. And if you get all 9 treasures and you get out alive and everything, then you survive. If not, then you lose. So the other mode to play in was two-player mode, and that's if you and a friend each had, like, if your friend had a Black Baron book and you had the White Warrior book, then you could actually, this is really cool, you'd both start on some page, again, whatever it tells you in the instructions in the front, and you guys can walk through the corridor together, but separately, and if either one of you sees the other one of you, then you go into combat mode. And so sometimes you would actually, you know, when you turn a page, you would actually see your opponent. And sometimes you would see him head on because you both see each other. Sometimes you would see your opponent just from like the side or from the back because he doesn't see you yet, and you can go attack him. You know, all kinds of cool stuff. It was really cool. And the two-player mode, if I recall correctly, has nothing to do with treasure chests. You're just supposed to kill each other. It's just a find, a search and destroy mission, and of course the books, you know, the intro to each book gives you, each of you, your own motivation on why you need to kill this person. You know, like in the White Warrior one, the Black Baron is the evil person who has come and conquered your land or whatever, whereas in the Black Baron one, then the White Warrior is the evil one who has, who's here to steal your treasure or something, I don't know. So yeah, it's you know, you're always playing the good guy from your own perspective. And so it was a really, really, really neat idea, and for whatever reason I was just kind of sitting around playing Dungeoneer, and I just thought, you know what would be cool is to hunt that book down. I mean, someone online's gotta know what that book series was called. And it didn't take me very long, to be honest. I was really surprised at how quickly I found it. It turns out that the mastermind behind this little four-book series was called, or it was named Joe Dever, or Joe Dever, D-E-V-E-R, anyway. And sadly, he just passed away. 2 months ago. I mean, it was like just at the turn of the new year, he passed away. And I know this now because I'm on a mailing list with some people who also are sort of Joe Dever fans, and that's how I found out. But anyway, so Joe was a musician in the 70s, and he did that for a while. He was a musician for a while until in 1977 he made the mistake of playing Dungeons and Dragons, and it had just come out. You know, this is a new game, and he played it, and he was completely blown away. Quit his whole, you know, musician as a day job thing, and became a game designer. And he made his first game called. Well, he won, I guess. I guess he was a professional, like, Dungeons and Dragons player or something, because in 1982 he won the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons World Championship, so he kind of became a big deal in the gaming world, I guess, at that point. That's when he quit and devoted his time to writing and doing game design. And the first work that he came out with publicly, anyway, was Flight from the Dark. So that's the book I'm going to be talking about today, although it's in a series. It's a whole series of books. So the world that Joe Dever created is known as, or the series, I should say, is known as the Lone Wolf series. And the Lone Wolf series begins with Flight from the Dark. It has about 28 books in it, or maybe 20, and then there's another series that he did, about 8 books in that one. So he's done a lot of these books, so you've got plenty to choose from, but let's talk about just this one. We'll focus on this one because they're all basically the same, you know, it's all the same mechanic. And so Flight from the Dark starts out with you being a Kai warrior. K-A-I. You're a Kai warrior, which I gather is a little bit like a samurai. You know, you live in this monastery with other Kai warriors, and you're young, and you're a new Kai warrior, so you're not very skilled, you don't know a whole lot, and one day you're out wandering the forest or the fields or something, and you come back to see a black cloud forming from the south, from the southern regions of the land where an ancient evil once dwelt. And now, of course, the darkness is returning, and not only is it returning, but it comes straight for the Kai Warrior Monastery and slaughters everyone there. Luckily, you were out at lunch at the time and didn't get slaughtered. So it's pretty much the standard fantasy opening if you've ever played any fantasy, you know, game where your main drive is revenge and that sort of thing. So it's a pretty standard setup. At least you're not, you know, going after a prophecy or something. But yeah, it's standard setup, but it's good. It's fine. It works. Now the cool thing is, once you sort of find this out in the book, you are dropped into the role playing part, the part where you get to actually be in the game. So you look at the bodies and you discover some basic supplies, like a sword, maybe, I forget, I think a small satchel of gold pieces, that sort of thing. And then the book drops out of the story for a moment and kind of gives you, or the book rather, drops out of the story and gives you the rules of the game. And the rules are fairly simple. You get to keep anything that you find, but you have to write it down on a notebook. You will choose a random number, and you'll be endowed with endurance, charisma, or strength, and health, or possibly even less than that. It's really simple stats. It's not a whole lot of stats to keep track of, which is quite appealing. And I'll probably get to why that's appealing later in this series. So you don't have a whole lot to manage, but you know, it's just really it's your health and your strength, and then whatever you pick up along the way, or lose along the way. In addition to all that, you get some special powers. You get to choose, I think, initially two powers from sort of what you were trained in as a Kai warrior. So those are things like camouflage or hunting or sixth sense or tracking or healing, weapon skill, and then you get to choose like what weapon specifically you have skill in. A mind shield, which is kind of like a, you know, mental strength against creatures with mental powers, or the other way around, a mind blast. Animal kinship, you can talk to animals. Mind over matter, you can move stuff with your mind, that sort of thing. So once you sort of create your character, I mean, your character is always your character, but you know, you're gonna be the Kai warrior dude, and that's who you are, and that's fine. But once you sort of get all of your stats and gather all of your equipment, you start reading the book. And the book is basically, if you've ever played a text adventure on a computer, it's like a text adventure, except it's on an e-reader or whatever format you find this book in. I just have it on my e-reader. But it's available also as HTML and PDFs and things like that, so you can just read it on your computer too. It sounds simple, and to give you an idea of how it goes, you know, it's just kind of like you're walking along a road, and then you come to a fork in the road, and you can go either left or right. If you want to go left, go to page 35. If you want to go right, go to page 85. That sort of thing. So it sounds kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure, right? Well, it's not really like a choose-your-own-adventure, or maybe it is, but maybe I've just always read the wrong choose-your-own-adventures. The ones that I've read, like, as a kid, were always super simple, and the stories all kind of boiled down to, like, 15 pages, you know? It was always kind of like, oh, these are... Yeah, this chunk is that one adventure, and there's not really ever any sense that two paths would ever cross. This book is unbelievably complex. You can actually look at a GNU plot or similar flow chart of all the different paths that you could possibly take in this and all books, in fact, because they've all been transcribed into XML, so some clever person has rendered all of that into flowcharts, and you can see like the paths and how they cross and how they intersect and how they diverge. It's amazing. It is stunning. I have played Flight from the Dark. Oh, I've played several of the books so far. Not once, not necessarily twice. In some cases, three times, and never have I had the same. You know, I've always felt like I was on a different book, like to an astonishing degree. I'm not saying like, you know how sometimes a DVD back in the day would come out with like the director's cut, you know, and you'd be watching and suddenly you'd sort of twitch and you'd be like, you know what, isn't this supposed to be a director's cut? I'm not seeing anything different from this. And then there's like one little scene that's like, oh, that was different. That was the director's cut right there. No, this is not like that. This is like a completely different experience every single read through. I'm sure you'd hit the ceiling at some point, but in terms of really feeling like it's a different story, between the fact that you've got, you know, 1,100 different paths to go along, you also have, I mean, you can play it. You know, your character's always the same, but you can play the character totally differently, either in your choices. You know, if you're into RPG, then you could give your character a little bit more of a backstory and just kind of decide that character's not going to, you know, I don't know, ever run from a fight, or that character hates animals, or that character never goes left, at Crossroads, you know, whatever. Like, you can play it differently each time, but then you also have different powers that you can choose from. So you can actually leverage the different powers on a different playthrough, and it will play differently. A couple of times, well, the way that the powers work is that, like, let's say that you've got tracking. Let's say you have tracking ability. So at some points, you might reach a crossroads, for instance, and I keep using a crossroad because it's an easy analogy to make, but you reach a crossroad, and it says you can go left, page 35, right, page 85, or if you have tracking, turn to page 99. Ah, so if you had chosen tracking, then you would go to 99, and it would tell you you see certain things on the road that make it look like most traffic has gone right, and you detect a foul odor from the left, you know, so you're more likely to go right, or whatever. Or if you have animal kinsmanship, you know, you might be walking along, and there'll be a crow along the side of the road, and you think, that would be cool to talk to that crow, and then you look at the choices, and it turns out, yes, you can either continue, or if you have animal kinsmanship, you can talk to the crow on page whatever. Now, the flip side of that, in terms of sort of the one of the weaker points of the books, I guess, would be that your powers, obviously the book is not fully interactive, right? I mean, it is a script. You're following a script. So if you're walking along and you see something that you think would be great to do, and the book doesn't give you that option, then there's no way to do that. If there's a horse pulling a cart, and you think, I should talk to that horse to see what's going on in the cart, and the book says that you can either get in the cart or you can keep walking, then those are your two choices, obviously. So that's, you know, it's a little bit of a constraint in terms of what you might be used to in an open-world video game. Yeah, or it might not be, just kind of depends. And certainly one could argue that in open-world, quote-unquote open-world video games, frequently, it only really has the illusion of that anyway, right? I mean, like, yes, you might be able to click on the horse and talk to the horse, but if the authors didn't think to put anything interesting in that horse's mouth, then all the horse is going to say is some kind of like witty remark that the other horse an hour ago also said, and that, you know, so there's the illusion of like, oh my gosh, I can do anything, but I mean, it's still all a script, and the same with the book. It's scripted. It's a book that you can play through. So, in addition to having special powers that kind of make your choices a little bit more interesting, you also do get to collect items along the way, and those items will come up later in the books. So, you know, you might find some armor that you can wear. Well, that'll help you in combat. You might find a gemstone that you pick up that could maybe later be handy to bargain with when you meet a wizard or something. You know, it's completely, or it may burn your hand because it came out of the stomach of an ogre and there's stomach acid all over it. You know, it really depends. Like, you never exactly know what you're in for in this book, and that's really, really great, because it just makes it so completely full of variety. Obviously, it's really astonishing how full of variety they manage to make it. Now, of course, the other thing that sets it apart from a choose your own adventure is the combat system, and that's what makes it, I guess, really feel like an RPG. Because I mean, most RPGs, maybe you don't get into combat that often, but then again, you know, you usually have to achieve something, right? You have to get over, you have to do something. So in the book, you have a lot of combat. I mean, not too much. There's a lot of exploration, and that's one of its strengths, I think. Some game books I've tried have relied very heavily on, especially single player, have relied very heavily on combat, because that's kind of like the easy thing to do. You know, lead the player to a corner and attack them, and they'll have to to do combat, and that's kind of like, that's the easy way to make it a game or feel like a game, without having to write, you know, a 200-page novel that's not even contiguous 200 pages. But this one really does balance it quite well, because he wrote like this series of 20 books or whatever it is, plus 8 of another series. I'm just rounding up and down on those numbers, but yeah, he's written a lot. So you get a lot, you get a great sense of the world. You're exploring, you know, like part of the book is the exploration. It's wondering what would happen if you went down that path. Even though it's kind of dark and dreary, you might find something interesting, and you could get some cool loot that you could then use against the undead that you're inevitably going to find when you go up the road the other way. So yeah, it's there's a lot of exploration in this. There's a lot of lore, you know, like finding out about what populates this world, who has history in one area, what wizard has been around here, and what he's doing now, and has he been captured? And it's just it's amazing, you know, what cultures are over here, what cultures are there. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. I'm trying to sort of tell you how fun it is without at the same time being too repetitive. So, the combat. Here's how the combat works. It is probably one of the best combat systems I've ever experienced in a solo game, ever. Pathfinder card game is a close second, but I think this one really, really gets it right. So the way that it works is that you have a combat skill. Your character has a combat skill. And you get that combat skill when you roll initially, when you're playing, you know, when you're creating your character. But you also get that that skill boosted possibly by either a special power, like if you had chosen a weapon mastery in a certain thing, and then you found that certain thing, like if you said, my character is really good with longswords. And then you end up finding a longsword, hey, guess what? You just got a 2 bonus on your combat skill. And if that longsword is also blessed with, you know, some kind of power of good from some ancient wizard or something, then hey, you might have an extra 2 points just from the sword itself. So the sword has a +2, you are good with swords, so you have a +2, plus your natural combat skill is an 8, so you've got 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12. And that would be good. Now, when you go into combat, of course, someone else has a combat skill of their own. So let's say that you encounter someone. You've got a 12 combat skill, and you encounter someone with a 10. So they're not bad. They're not great. They're not bad. So you subtract the combat skill of your enemy from your combat skill to create your combat ratio. So 12 minus 10 is 2. So the combat ratio is 2. And from then on, you roll for what kind of hit you... Well, what kind of battle you've just experienced, or what kind of turn, you know, each turn, how much damage has been done. And this is done in a combat results table. And this is where it's truly, truly brilliant. There are 2 tables, one with negative numbers and one with positive numbers along the top. And that's your combat ratio along the top. Down the side are random numbers, 1 through 0, or 1 through 10, I guess. So if you roll, for instance, a 3, say you got a 3 at a combat ratio of 2, so you would go to the positive table, so 0, 1, 2 along the top, and then down on the third row, so second column, third row, or actually first 1 and 2, actually, well, never mind. So let's call it the second column, third row, and it tells you that if that is what you got, then your enemy has dealt 6 damage. No, sorry, has received 6 damage, and you have received 3 damage. Now let's say you roll a 7. That's pretty good. So again, second column, and then 7th row. In that case, your enemy takes 10 damage, and you only take 1 damage. and so on. So if you had, let's say you were still at 12, and then you encountered like a big, terrible beast with a really, really strong combat skill. Let's call it a like a 20. So that would set your combat ratio to negative 8. That's not good. So now you go to your negative table, go to the 8 column, the negative 8 column, and then you roll, let's say you roll a 4. So at a 4 combat hit, you take 2 damage. No, sorry, your enemy takes 2 damage, and you have taken 6 damage. Ouch. And it's not until you roll like a 10 on that. You have to roll a 10 in order to get your enemy gets 8 damage and you get 0 damage done to you. So when the combat ratio is lower, you're at a disadvantage, obviously. You know, like you're rolling and you may do some damage, but you might get more damage done to you. But if you're at a high ratio, then typically you're going to do more damage, but depending on how you roll, you may also take damage. So it's a fantastic way of doing combat, and I'll tell you why, because you might not see how brilliant that is. You might think that that's just sort of a way to do combat. But if you've ever played a solo game, then you'll know that when you're doing the solo game, you're no matter what, like, no matter how good the AI is in whatever you're playing, during the combat, you pretty much are playing two characters. Like, there's just no way around that. So you have to roll for your enemy, and you have to roll for yourself. And that's okay, it works, but not as well as this. Because this is one smooth action. You calculate your combat ratio, and from then on, all you do is roll. You roll once, you roll 1d10, and you're good. You've got both values of damage. You do the calculations. You know, you take the points away, and then you keep going in combat. It seems like a small thing, but if you play it, if you actually play and try to do both calculations yourself, it gets really annoying really fast, and because it just slows you down. You know, you're not only are you controlling your opponent, which doesn't seem as fun. You know, it's just like, well, I'm rolling for myself, oh, and now I'm rolling for my opponent. It's just kind of like, wait, why am I rolling for my opponent? That's AI. That should be calculated for me. And that's what the combat result table does for you. It calculates all that stuff, figures out how things are going to go, and then all you're doing is rolling. And you're rolling for, essentially, you know, how well you did in that round. And you find out, and then you roll again. And so it's a brilliant, brilliant way. It really, really works. I'm probably going to use the combat table in other games, in other game books, because it's just such a smooth method of doing combat. It really, really is. It's really nice. So that is the combat system in Lone Wolf series. Really well worth checking out. One of the curiosities of the series is the way that it has that it seeks to be completely self-contained. So it ensures that if you bought that book, you pretty much, that's all you need for the game. Like, you're good to go. So maybe you'll have a d10, or maybe you won't. And if you don't, there's a random number table in the back of the book. So you can just kind of close your eyes, and you run your finger over this table, and you stop your finger, and you look at where you landed, and that's the number that you rolled. I never have used that. I didn't want to use that. I didn't feel like my brain would allow me to believe that that was random. I have my own random dice, my own random number generator that I mentioned on the show about the pocket dice roller here on Hacker Public Radio. But it's still cool that he was seeking to make the book completely self-contained, and I think that's a very admirable goal, because you can't, I don't think you should assume that people are going to just automatically have a D10, and even if they are, they may not, it might not, you know, they're reading a book, it might not be convenient to roll a D10. And whenever I say that, people look at me funny. It's just like, why wouldn't you be able to just roll a d10? Or why wouldn't you be able to just pull out your phone and roll an emulated dice? And it's just kind of like, well, that's not what I want to do. I want the analog experience, but I don't want to have to roll a clunky dice around while I'm reading a book. People don't understand that, but I don't care. Now, the really, really cool thing, but yet another really, really cool thing about the series is that the books, so the first book, Flight from the Dark, is not complete. It drops you off at whatever goal you achieve at the end of the book, which I'm not going to tell you for spoiler purposes, but, you know, you get to the point where you get to, and that's the end of the book. And then you, if you want to continue that adventure, you have to read the next book. Fire on the Water, or Fire Over Water, something like that. Fire on the Water. And so it's continuous, so you're still playing the same character, and you can actually level up a little bit. You get, since you've already read one book, you get two more special traits, special powers in the second book. You get a little bit of a freshener, you know, a freshen up here and there. Like, you get, well, obviously your health gets restored, but you get, I think you probably get some stuff from the you know, you get extra stuff, extra loot and things, but you also get to carry what you got in the first book over, so you're, you know, it's not like you're resetting, it's actually a continuous story. Now, the third book is its own book, although it does have a couple of things. I mean, you're still the same character, and there are some things that carry over into it, but it's a separate thing that happens a little bit after the second book. But the more you play, pretty much the more you advance, so you become more and more powerful. Now, the thing about that is that I did start to feel like maybe I was maybe a little bit overpowered in some parts, like, because, you know, they kind of had to keep the book. For new users, the book had to keep everything at the new level, but you're level 3, you know, by the time you get to the third book. So yeah, sometimes I felt like I was maybe doing a lot more damage than probably was fair. And that said, I didn't care. I still had a ball. It was just so fun. There is that satisfaction that comes from just being indomitable, you know, just like, I'm really powerful and I've earned it, and yes, I am going to kill all of you quickly. So yeah, there's, you know, I'll see how far I take that. Like, I don't know when in this series your character, you know, you have to sort of give up that initial character. I think there might be one or two more books in this kind of story arc. And then from there, I believe it crosses over to a different story, which maybe at that point you reset your character. I'm not sure. I haven't gotten there yet. But it is a lot of fun, and it's got a story arc, and it's got the sense of leveling and character development, great combat, and it's replayable amazingly. I mean, like, really, I really thought that after I played it the first time, I thought, okay, I played the first book first time, I should probably just go on to the second book. But something compelled me to try it again, because I just thought, I played it as a rogue the first time, I'm going to play it as a tank the second time. And I did that, and it was a completely different experience. So yes, 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 replayable, replayable, replayable. It is just a treat to experience. You have to try it if you are into gaming, and especially if you are into solo gaming, because this is the way to do it. This is the absolute pinnacle of solo gaming, I think. It's just a heck of a lot of fun. It is, I should mention, it's a game. You know, it's like really a game. Don't think that you're going to sort of sit in bed one night and sort of read this and kind of, you know, mostly read. It's not like that. It is a game book. You need a pencil and a pen and a pencil, whatever, and a pad of paper. You need some form of random number generation. you're putting the book down a lot and calculating numbers. You know, it's writing loot down that you collect, striking stuff off that you lost, and it does throw curveballs at you. You know, I mean, like, I'd built up a pretty solid arsenal at one point, and then something happened. You know, somehow I got myself into a story arc that I didn't expect, and I lost like a lot of my stuff. It was horrible. I mean, like, everything was going perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden I have lost my bag of holding, and I am in a river fighting a goblin. I mean, it was absolutely horrible. I had nothing left. I was literally fighting with my hands for at least 10 or 12 pages afterwards. It was the most desperate, nail-biting, just the most tense game experience I'd had in ages. It was just so good and so unexpected. That was the thing. It was like I'd had everything planned out. I knew exactly what was going to happen, and then it threw me this curveball. So it's really, really good. And the best part about this game book, I should mention, is that it is free. It's available for free online. In fact, all of the books are available for free online because Joe graciously allowed all of his books to be published and downloaded free of charge on the internet. He called it as his millennium gift to all those devoted readers who had kept the Kai flag flying high. And so, yeah, we all benefit from that. You can find all of this stuff at projectaon.org. That's projectaon.org. That is projectaon.org. If you go there, you choose your language, go into the site, go to books, and you can start downloading them. Like I say, they're in PDF, they're in HTML, and they're in EPUB, so you can read them in a variety of different ways. Just start at the beginning and just go for it. Knock yourself out. It's well worth it. I cannot recommend this series highly enough to you. It is solid, solid gaming. And that's all I'll say, I think, about the series and the book. Because I think if I haven't sold it on you by now, then there's no selling it to you at all. It's well worth it. Go check it out. Have fun. Let me know what you think.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.